Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. Dismissing your Skype messages on my wrist because they don't show up on my computer.
Okay. I think our audience loves the 30 seconds at the start of every show where there are minor grievances leveled against a program.
I mean, every week it does something new. It's new and surprising and interesting, and it keeps the relationship interesting, is what I'm saying. The
Would you say it's creepy and it's kooky, mysterious, and or spooky?
I think it qualifies as mysterious.
Oh, I think I would categorize it as ooky, but to each their own.
If I worked in like a really like not funny at all office environment, I would dress up as Skype for Halloween, and everyone would be like, "Oh, look at you, scariest costume in the office." Get it? 'Cause Skype is terrible.
Well, I mean, you could do that at your private home office,
Just gonna wear all blue spandex outfit with a big S on my shirt.
yeah, it just Petey would be a little confused probably, but we'd probably get over it, I would assume. You're still the same Dan who takes him outside and gives him food.
I mean, maybe when I like walk down to the corner to get the mail at like 4 p.m., I'd get some funny stares. Actually, people would just think I had my last name on my shirt and that I was really into blue spandex or something.
Supersturm.
Yeah, Superstorm, exactly.
More powerful than a steaming
Pile of
something.
poo. How's it going on your side of the pond? We're on the same side of the pond, but it's fun to say on your side of the pond.
Well, I'm sure there's a pond somewhere between us geographically.
It's true. There's got to be at least one pond between wherever
Statistically
you are in
speaking,
California
there must
today.
be some body of water that separates us.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't even matter which route you take, whether you take the northern route or the slightly less northern route.
Yes. That's that like that old Irish song. You take the northern route and I'll take the slightly less northern route.
exactly.
We'll see who gets to Ahwatukee before ye.
Exactly. I mean, depending on your perspective, all routes could be north.
Is that like all roads lead to
Yeah,
Rome or something?
all roads lead to Rome, and if you happen to live in, I don't know, South America or something, all routes are northern.
Well, what if you're trying to get to southern Rome?
I think it's like a Mobius thing. Like it just kicks you back out into a ring road that takes you right back into Rome.
Interesting.
Mobius Rome.
Well,
Mobius Rome sounds like a transformer or something.
or an EDM track. But yeah, so we've concluded our month of Foxtober with the rather anticlimactic Weekend at Bernie's, perhaps.
I would not call Weekend at Bernie's anticlimactic. I've been thinking about it since we did it. I mean, partly because I was in a pseudo tropical type place with beaches and stuff, and it kind of reminded me of Weekend at Bernie's. Although there were no dead people pretending to be alive, as far as I'm aware. I mean, any more so than like retired people in Florida are dead people pretending to be alive. Get
Yes, zing.
it?
Yeah.
It's real funny.
I enjoyed your messages about how you were encountering Florida life things.
Florida came right out of the gate, being all Florida. Like day one was like, "Hello, welcome to Florida."
What'd you think of the humidity? It's a wet heat.
It honestly wasn't that bad. The temperature stayed reasonable, and the humidity was mostly decent. I think the first day we were there was the warmest, so the evening was still a little muggy. But in general, it was very reasonable and pleasant, and even a little chilly at points when the wind would kick up.
It's unusual for Central Florida, but yeah, it is what it is.
I
And
enjoyed it.
you, as you said, you had a photo of a police encounter that you witnessed from your breakfast.
It was real peculiar. We were in a place called New Smyrna Beach, which I are you familiar with? I mean, you've probably
I
heard
have
of.
never had the chance.
Never had. Well, it's very small. They have a little like, I don't, you can't even call it a downtown. There's like a little strip that has like four restaurants and or bars on it. Anyway, so we were at one of those four places.
Is it bigger or smaller than Old Smyrna Beach?
I think this is one of those MacGuffins. I don't think there is an Old Smyrna Beach unless Old Smyrna Beach is like in England, and this is just another one of those things like, yeah, we're going to stick it to the old world kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's a Mobius situation where you try to go to Old Smyrna Beach and it just takes you back to New Smyrna Beach?
Well, yes, but not really intentionally. I think it's because when you try to go to Old Smyrna Beach, you run into the roadblock because there's the farmer's market where they're selling artisanal honey, which is not artisanal, and some lady's like weaving baskets or something, and then you have to make three left turns and you're right back where you are.
Seems like you really enjoyed your time.
Yeah, at the farmer's market, there was some woman had a tent selling Thai food, and just hearing the 60-year-old white woman ask if the Thai food was spicy or not before she tried any of it was just great. It was just so perfect.
Well, you got to be careful. They can't always take the spice down there.
Yeah.
No.
They got peppers. You got other peppers.
I was watching a cooking show where someone said, "Oh, this is, you know, plenty spicy. Because there's already black pepper in there." And I was just like, wait a minute.
What, were they from Florida?
No, I don't remember what the cooking show was. I was flipping through. It was just a moment that made me think that's pretty horrible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, everyone, it's a spectrum of spice. Yeah. But we were down there in the little downtown, the new Old Smyrna Beach, and we found one of the two restaurants. The other one was a pizza place. I ordered a Cuban sandwich because I was on a hunt. My first meal, I wanted a Cuban sandwich. I don't care if it was breakfasty time, sort of. It was like, I don't know, like 10:45, 11 o'clock or something. But then we're sitting by they have this lovely, like, you know, the whole front of the building is like a sliding glass window because, you know, the weather is nice in Florida and you got to imagine they want to take advantage of that. So this is slid open. So we're kind of sort of on the patio-ish, but still inside the building. And from down the street, you hear police sirens, and they're very loud because they're just echoing off the brick buildings. And he comes screeching up basically in front of the place because it's a T-stop. So a road comes straight at us and then goes either left or right. There's nowhere to go straight because you would be coming straight at the restaurant where we're at. So the cop stops on one corner, the far corner. He runs over to the oncoming lane and lays out a spike strip, just big, long spike strip. And then he goes back and hides by his car. And then a big gray SUV slowly approaches the spike strip, and he looked confused, like he maybe had like the wrong vehicle or he was on the wrong corner or something. So he slowly pulled the spike strip out of the way of the car, just in time for the car to realize that no, in fact, the spike strip was for it, and he had made the mistake. So the car sped off, turning right as fast as it possibly could, and then the police officer went running after it with his gun drawn, as if he was going to, I don't know what, shoot the driver as it was speeding away, which I don't think you're supposed to do. But the thing that struck me the most was that if the spike strip had actually functioned properly and the car had driven over it and blown its tires out, it would have skidded directly into the restaurant where we were sitting. So that would have been helpful. And then, you know, the waitress came over and she was like, oh, you know, I showed her the picture I had there. And she said, yeah, that's crazy. Can you believe that happened? And then she proceeded to tell us a story about how this big handy sliding glass bay window that they have in the front of their restaurant, which is very lovely, is due to a drunk driver about 10 years ago just driving through the front of the building. And it was cheaper to rebuild that the sliding glass door than actually to put a wall back in there. So, you know, I guess this happens more often than you might imagine.
Oh, that's a comforting thought. Yeah. But so you were in Florida, of course, for a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a family wedding.
It was a family wedding.
Would you say that there were some stern family values going on, or how would you characterize?
This is not a stern family per se. This is my fake family. That's not real family, but family.
Oh.
But there were certainly some values on display. That's for sure.
Oh, that's good. I of course say that not as a way for you to further incriminate yourself with your family members, but to segue us into a film, into a movie. Do you get where I'm going with this? Do you have any idea what movie I might be talking about?
I think based on your reference to values, I think you may be referencing 1993's Addams Family Values, the sequel to the Addams Family movie that we haven't talked about, but you know, since it's November, and we got to pick themes for things, Adam Family Values kind of fit a theme that
we were
attempting to create.
Do you want to say what the theme is, Dan?
No, you can do the theme. Go ahead.
Okay. No thanks, Vember.
Yeah, because Thanksgiving is in November. It's a big holiday in America. I don't think they have it everywhere.
No, I believe that they certainly do not, Dan. There is a Thanksgiving in Canada, but it happens on, October 12th or something every year.
We just missed it.
Yeah. So, I mean, who cares? But the important thing is that the American custom is pretty weird and silly and racist when you start digging down into certain things about pilgrims and whatnot.
I'm not sure you even have to dig down that far.
No, not really.
Any of that.
It's a very it's a shallow grave.
Oh. No.
No, no, what?
That's on theme brand or whatever, but...
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah. No, did I ever tell you the time I got in trouble in fifth grade? Because we were learning about Christopher Columbus, and I drew a picture of him standing on a headless body holding a sword with a head on top of it, and my teacher thought it was very inappropriate, even though I was basically depicting what had occurred, and I didn't understand why it was bad to draw that picture.
Oh, yeah, I could see how there's problems. But
parent teacher conference is what that was.
it's one of those situations where. The school really should have expected that perhaps someone might actually look into the history of one of the history lessons rather than, you know, just think that it was all delicious food and happy smiles.
You can't end the lesson about the whole encounter with, and then the Americans killed a lot of them, and not think that that would be impressionable on small children.
No, yeah. So it's a little bit of a rough thing, especially. How should I put this? I don't feel like this movie, even though it is obviously not on the side of the pilgrims. I feel like this movie is not particularly sensitive to these issues and topics.
I think this movie is a PG-13 1993 movie, and it's not particularly it has enough Thanksgiving content to qualify itself for No Thanks Vember for our podcast. It's not really a Thanksgiving movie per se.
No, because what's weird is, and I'd completely forgotten about this, the Thanksgiving play is put on during summer camp.
Yeah.
Which is...
in the summer. It's right there in the name.
Yeah. But the reason for that, of course, is because they didn't release this in the summer. They released this later in the year. And it would be around Halloween time and stuff, so might as well just tie it in. And I believe they had a trick-or-treating scene in the first Addams Family movie or something.
That sounds about
related.
Right. I can't remember what it was, though.
Yeah. We should also get into the fact that we did this because of Thanksgiving tie-ins, and Dan had raised the concern that we had not covered the first movie, and so, oh no, people will be so lost and confused, and...
That's not how we roll here. We when we go for a franchise, we start at the beginning, and we do all of them, whether we want to or not.
Except if it's Jurassic Park, and then we do them in reverse.
Well... the worlds are kind of their own franchise. There's an exception to be made there. It's not literally like Jurassic Park 1 and Jurassic Park 2 were in reverse.
Yeah, I would say that you would be fine skipping the first movie. I don't particularly like the first film. It's been a really long time since I've seen it. But it's not interesting bad or interesting good. It's just
I feel like
kind
you're
of...
describing this movie too, though.
No, I disagree, because I think that this movie has a lot of silly, incredibly stupid jokes that
okay, well, all right, so I guess
enjoy.
The first one is, the first movie is basically, if you remove Joan Cusack from this movie, it's the same thing.
No, I disagree. I think there's like, satirical stuff in here that's not in the first film. The first film is just sort of like, look how weird this family is, it's so weird. And in this one, it's like, look how weird this family is, also here's satire. It's not... the sharpest most beautifully written, incisive satire, but I'll take it. It's an improvement.
It's, you got a baby with a mustache in this one. The first one was really just about like what is family when you really when it really comes down to it. How do you define family and how do you let people in or recognize family?
Yes, and this one is the same. In terms of
for me,
family,
it involves heavy drinking in Florida. In this one, it involves like bombs and knives and things.
Yeah. Well, also the first one is about manipulating Fester. And the second one is about manipulating Fester. So they really stretched the character of Fester as far as it could go, I guess.
Is that why he's so doughy?
No, he seems very tense. But
somebody needs to knead the dough before they can stretch it properly.
I'm not sure where you're going with that.
If you catch my drift.
I don't. Moving on. I know that
you
had sent me some
peculiar theme in this movie.
You sent me some critical messages about Christopher Lloyd's performance as Uncle Fester in this.
Well, and he's basically like giving every performance and like shaking his face side to side and having his cheeks make funny noises and just like straining his face so veins are popping out and he looks like he's having a difficult time and he could benefit from some Ex-Lax or something.
Yes, I agree. I don't care for what he's doing on screen very much, but it's kind of, I don't know, Christopher Lloyd does not hold back ever and do like a reserve performance, or if he has, I have not come across it. Everything is usually like shouting and running and shouting some more.
The part about his performance that like the only thing that overshadows how over the top his face is the fact that like the pillow they've jammed under his shirt like comes up to his nose, so he's like he's constantly trying to like look over his own fake chest to see things, and it's just it's a little much. It's a little too much poof under the shirt.
Yeah, well, they tried to make him more like the shape of the comic drawing, but it's not something they did with any of the other characters, so I don't know why they felt like that was a requirement. But
it kind of works when he's standing. But
yeah, because it was really about it's not just like making him larger; it's also like removing his neck. that is a major component. He just sort of has this no neck like strained thing with when combined with his grimace and vein popping and eyeball popping out of his head. It gives a certain look. Like one of those little squeezy stress toys where the face pops out.
The eyes and the nose and the ears and things.
Yep.
Yeah, those are cool.
And we also have the return of characters from the first film. And you've got Gomez Adams, who is portrayed by the late Raul Julia, who is great. He has a very Shakespearean presence for what is an incredibly ridiculous role where he's saying the most absurd lines, but he's delivering them with gusto every time. And you've got Angelica Houston as Morticia. She has a very reserved performance. She doesn't really do or say much. It's mainly about
it's mainly about finding the light so the streak goes across her eyes.
Yes, I would say 97% of her performance is that light across her eyes.
I think half of the cinematography budget for this movie went to all of the different flags and lights that they would need so that Morticia's light didn't fall on Gomez and vice versa when they're standing 2 feet apart.
Yeah, there are some complicated shots, too, where Gomez is standing still and then she enters frame, but she enters frame into the light on her eyes. Mm-hmm. Like she doesn't they don't do the reverse of that where he just walks in and she's standing still the whole entire time. So they went through planning and probably multiple takes of that in order to get that to work. And it's just like ultimately why? But yeah, it kind of becomes entertaining in and of itself after a while when you're just watching where they struggle to put the light on her face. And there is nothing else that motivates that lighting anywhere else. No other character or anything has that. So it is entertaining. You've got Wednesday, who's Christina Ricci again, and Pugsley, who is someone. And
he didn't do much other than these movies.
No. He went on to be a production assistant on Star Trek Insurrection, I'll have you know.
Of course you would know that.
but he it's not a lot. You also have the return of Dan Hedaya's wife from the first one. He died, of course, and she married Cousin It. They had a baby. That's the baby's name's What. Sort of a frightening little hairball thing. So that's charming. Mm-hmm. The introduction of Debbie, who's played by Joan Cusack, and who is, I think, steals every scene that she's in with her scenery chewing and sort of manic, insincere smile. It's fun. She's like a very flat, poorly drawn character, but again, it's mainly about just chatting your lines that I enjoy. I like her. And she's got some good stuff in here. She got a Malibu Barbie, and that started her off in this path of homicidal mania. Mm-hmm. She's a ballerina, you know, so she's graceful.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah. Don't buy your kids Malibu Barbie, basically.
No, or they'll burn you alive. And the introduction of the baby, who was introduced rather peculiarly by Morticia saying that she's going to have a baby now, and then rush off to a hospital scene. And you get the camp counselors, Peter McNichol and Christine Baranski. Mm-hmm. And then there's another little kid who's blonde that I don't know. And then there's David Krummels, who's in here.
Yeah, David Krummels is great. He's always pretty great. He's always pretty much him.
Yeah,
anxiety-ridden, sarcastic.
He does a good job, especially for, you know, considering where he is at in his career in this film. I think this might have been like one of the first things he did, but he does a good job of being somewhat interested in Wednesday Addams, but also being just sort of disturbed and weirded out by her. It's a little strange at the end when he's like, "I'm going to cosplay as your father."
He wants to be part of the family. Who knows? Maybe it was Wednesday's idea to help him sort of, you know, act the part to fit in a little bit better.
Yeah. Oh, I almost forgot Kiara Kane as grandma. She's under some makeup. Little bit.
She's got a lot of fake teeth and or just makeup on her teeth to make them look like gums, but they don't look like gums. They look like pink teeth.
Yeah, or like those, if you go to a dentist's office and they have those like fake, gums with teeth in them to like demonstrate, you know, cavities and stuff.
Oh, yeah, and then you just pull a bunch of them out.
Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. She does like a couple things. She has some lines, but nothing much going on there. And
she gives a curse to Joan.
It's a good curse, mostly because of her sunny disposition, which is it's the reason why you go to Carol Kane, I feel like. But
they should have left some of the teeth modification out, because her dialogue is a little muddy at times because she's just chewing on plastic or whatever it is in her mouth there.
Well, Carol Kane is not known for her enunciation.
I suppose that might be why a lot of her stuff in Princess Bride sounds like ADR.
Yeah. But I mean, I still enjoy her. And
Scrooged, come on, that was great.
Yeah, she's fantastic as the ghost of Christmas Present.
You remember the cover of Scrooge that you photoshopped my face onto?
Yes. How could I forget?
Somebody just liked that on Instagram like yesterday, and that was what, like 2.5 years ago that you did that?
Yeah.
Still popular.
Yeah, still raking in those likes.
still raking in them social likes.
Yeah. And we have Lurch, who's played by the guy who is Luxana Troy's little butler valet guy on Star Trek The Next Generation.
It's the dude from Men in Black with the forehead.
Yes. Also that. This is... and speaking of Men in Black, Tony Shalhoub has a weird cameo in here.
Yeah. Sonnenfeld.
Yeah. Well, this is before he did Men in Black, but you also have Nathan Lane as a police officer in one scene. It's just like, okay.
I love Nathan Lane in general, and the choice to make him a police officer is, it fits this movie. It's an inspired choice, I would like to say.
Yeah.
It makes no sense, but.
Well, he's this sarcastic, surly, you know, doesn't have any time for your garbage police officer guy. So
he's running the front desk.
Yeah, it works out well with the particular concerns that Gomez tries to express to Nathan Lane, because they're not really like emergency things. So
they have a Buick. If that's not an emergency, I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's a real crisis. But this movie is just, you know, having some fun. It's just playing around a little, and I feel like it doesn't have to do as much of the setup that the first movie has to go through. You just kind of take it. You just take it as evidence that these characters exist. And even if you don't watch the first film, you can also just take it as evidence that these characters exist, because they're just all weird. And also, they don't. How should I put this? There is nothing about them that is realistic or needs to be realistic or needs to make any sense logically. Like, if you try to map out their like motivations as characters or like what their personal philosophies are, it does not map to anything. No. You have a series of points on a very empty dartboard. This is one of probably, I think, the weirder things about the film is like you start to wonder, like, they talk about murdering people and homicide and acquitted, you know, manslaughter and things like that a lot. And they do actually kill someone by baking them alive inside of a cake.
Yes.
But they don't seem to actively want to murder everyone. It raises a couple questions about, like, are they kidding most of the time? But then they did kill that one person and just, like, it was no big deal, so maybe they do actually like to kill everybody.
Well, that was just a whoopsie, and you know, I think the difference here is that they're sadists more than anything else. So it's not really about the murder per se. It's about the pain and the torture and the misery and the depression and stuff that they really lean on to. And side effects,
like,
some of those hobbies can be death. But you know, I've never seen Hellraiser. Is that a thing?
Oh my God! Have you never seen Hellraiser?
It never appealed to me to make me want to watch it.
Oh, it's bad. Particularly in terms of like the look of it and the over the top cheese aspect of it.
Well, I know there's a cube. And there's a guy with pins in his face, mm-hmm. and then. Is it like a portal to another dimension? I don't know what is it space? Is it from outer space?
So you solve the Rubik's Cube and it opens up a portal to hell. And then the minions come forth through the portal, assuming that you solve the Rubik's Cube because you want to go to hell to experience all of the pain and pleasure that's there because you are into stuff.
People know what's behind the Rubik's Cube and they solve it voluntarily?
Yes, unless you are the protagonist of the film, and then you don't know that.
And then if you're just like a nerd who likes Rubik's Cubes, and you're like, look how fast I can solve this Rubik's Cube, you should videotape me and put me on YouTube, and then suddenly you're in hell.
Yes, basically. Huh. And then you have to try to get yourself out of that situation that you got yourself into by opening up that gate. So, you know, some tricky negotiation needs to be done. And then you have a second movie where... you just jump the shark and go full throttle into, like, let's actually go to hell in this one and play around there. And then let's have a bad guy who's worse than the other bad guys from the first film. And then they have to ally with the protagonist against that bad guy. And then that new bad guy is taken care of. And then you have a third film and somehow it has the return of the defeated bad guy from the first film in it again, somehow, and then it's actually the ghost of him that's still good is reaching out to tell you how to defeat him. So anyway, the series gets progressively worse, is the point. And they've tried to reboot it and recast like Pinhead and stuff, although I think the majority of the times that he has appeared on film, it's been the same British actor guy. But it is Clive Barker's claim to fame, as much fame as that might be. But it's a mess. It's a real cheesy mess of a movie.
Question. When you have solved the Rubik's Cube and accidentally sent yourself to hell, do you get out of hell by getting one of those little, the little cup on the end of a stick, and then you got the string with the ball on it, and you have to flick the ball into the little cup?
No, it is not Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Oh, does that happen in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey?
I thought it did. Wasn't that one of the
maybe
things?
I don't remember. I was going to say, so maybe if it's not that, is it one of those ones where you've got the two nails where they're like bent with a little circle in the middle and they're interlinked and you got to kind of twist them at a certain angle so you can separate the nails from each other?
No.
Hmm. Hmm.
Hmm. But anyway, it's neither here nor there. I wonder.
Yeah, it's not about Hellraiser.
I wonder. That'd be an interesting crossover. Hellraiser and the Addams Family. Yeah.
I feel like they would all just like hang out and smoke cigars and talk about stuff and like laugh.
Maybe not. But
share stories about the different people they've tortured.
Yeah. 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 For sure. Definitely. And the different forms of strange, awful pleasure things that they mutter about every now and then. One of the weirder things about Gomez and Morticia is just their constant muttering about stuff. And doesn't seem romantic or sexy, but they seem really turned on by it.
Well, I mean, you know, people don't really get to choose what they are attracted to, so.
Yeah. But anyway, they have a baby in this one. The kids are jealous of the baby, and they try to kill the baby. But then baby's day out shenanigans occur whenever that happens. The baby's fine. The baby has a mustache, as you said.
And some very black hair that definitely does not look painted on.
No, and some very pale white blue corpse makeup on.
On most of the face, but not really around the eyes, probably because they didn't want to get in the baby's eyes. It looks like the inverse of our president, where the baby is pale everywhere except the eyelids.
Yeah, and you can really see it in some of these scenes where they're handing the baby around, particularly like the back of the head and stuff in the neck, where I just assume it rubbed off.
It's just all smudgy, and you can see the regular skin tone underneath.
Yeah, and so... There's a baby. The baby, fortunately, doesn't do a whole lot, and they don't actually like center much of it on it. The baby is just sort of a cartoon.
The baby, a boy named Pubert, played by two girls, twins.
Is it Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen?
It's Caitlin and Kristen Hooper.
Oh, that was close. They got the baby, and so they try to get a nanny, and this is what introduces us to Debbie, who is not really a nanny, but is somehow she's become wise to the fact that the Adamses have money, and she has a very complicated plan to get herself romantically engaged and married to Fester in order to extract wealth from him and then kill Fester.
I forget, was the money from the first movie? Is that why Christopher Lloyd was pretending to be Fester? Was to get to Gomez's money?
Yeah,
but then turned out to actually be Fester.
Yes,
or not, or whatever.
Yeah,
but where did Gomez get his money? I don't remember that.
They never really like say, but there's basically like a dungeon somewhere full of gold. Dan Hedaya knows it's there, and he wants in. Which is why they're trying to get Fester in the first one, and they've like found him in the Bermuda Triangle or something like that, and he doesn't have any memory of who he is, so he could be Fester, and of course he is. But that is the real central part of that movie. And then Dan Hedaya dies. But it's all about getting his hands on the money. And so in this one, I don't know how she knows about it, but she seems well informed.
And I like that Fester, it's not just a dungeon full of gold. He's got stocks, he's got IRAs, he's got other investments. It's like, really? I never really pegged Uncle Fester as being a real cunning investor.
No. Cunning investor. No, but...
Ugh, gross.
But, yeah, they... I'm not sure that it's necessarily that he has done these investments, and maybe these are just investments that are in his name. You know how sometimes old people for babies will buy them bonds because it's not that expensive and it turns into money later. But much, 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 much later, much to the chagrin of anyone who realizes they have a bond that they can't collect for 10 or 20 years.
Well, I think what you're saying is that the Adams family is actually a bunch of money launderers. So they're trying to hide where they got their dungeon full of gold and or blood diamonds or whatever they got down there. Mm-hmm. And they're converting that into modern currency on Wall Street, where it is sanitized and they appear to be legit, like the mob.
That is one interpretation.
Well, I mean, they're basically like the Disney Sopranos or whatever. Like they're creepy people who like to kill people, but they're silly and funny.
Yeah. Well, they're not. It's never seemed motivated by money. In fact, they don't really seem to care about money. But they also don't seem to want to spend frivolously either. Nor do they seem to want to spend money on prudent repairs like, fixing stairwells or painting the outside of the house.
No, they like it to be decrepit, but you know they've all got their various dresses and tuxedos and top hats and things. So they've got some money. They put it where they want it.
Underground cave tango bar that they go to. Remember the restaurant?
Yes, that was theirs.
No, I mean, but they obviously, that was not, wasn't like a value menu kind of a thing, I think.
Oh, sure, yeah, night out of town, they're going to live it up big, you know, and they set part of it on fire, too, and, you know, it's going to take a little bit out of the deductible, so they got to have some cash laying around.
Exactly. So, they have money and they know how to spend wisely when needed on
tango
expenses.
Well, they spend it on the things that are important to them, really. They're not just buying what the wire cutter tells them to buy. They're spending their money on the good guillotines and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. You want the real quality stuff that won't wear out so that your children can play with it.
You kidding me? You remember back in the 80s, Black & Decker used to make that one guillotine that would last 30 years, and nowadays you can buy a guillotine, it breaks in 6 months.
Dan.
Dan. Toasters. Toasters.
Dan, I know. Dan.
It's fun to try and be like other podcasts, but not really.
I have a Black & Decker toaster oven, but and it hasn't
broken yet. Toaster oven? We still haven't pulled the trigger on a toaster oven just because, well, mostly because we're out of counter space, but...
No. Also, you don't want to dip into the Sturm family fortune of gold bullion that's in your name.
Yeah, exactly. We got to use that for, sweatpants or whatever. That's like my version of the Adams family spending their money on bowling balls and guillotines. The Sturm family spends our money on sweatpants and Nikes or whatever. I don't know.
So I've had this for many years, and I got it for like $60 at Macy's. It's nothing to write home about. I believe...
Prices are going
to
go up now. They lost all their competition from Sears.
I believe that a certain person who reviews toaster ovens ended up reviewing a later but similar model to it and said that it was decent at all the cooking aspects of it, but did not like the knobs, which I would agree with because I also don't like the knobs on it.
Good mouth feel for the food, bad button feel for the fingers.
I was really hoping you weren't going to go with mouth feel and knobs, but...
I mean, you know, this is also from the same sect of people who control their watches with their noses and or tongues, so you know, you never know.
Yeah, you gotta be careful. A lot of weirdos out there.
Have you ever pushed a button on your watch with your nose?
No.
Neither have I.
No. Sometimes I use my pinky finger, though.
Well, it's just, you know, you got 10 fingers. Why not use them all? It's what they're there for.
But...
Give somebody else a chance once in a while. You can't just, like, let Mr. Hero Pointer Finger get all the good stuff.
Speaking of, there's something weird here where Fester expresses that he wishes that he had a romantic relationship and is envious of Gomez and Morticia and what they have and how he's lonely. And Gomez points out that he has Thing, which is an incredibly disturbing thought.
I think I must have missed that line. Oh, was that in the same scene where they looked at the pinup of their mother?
Yes.
I think this is where the writers were like, we need to make every scene like kind of weird in Adam's family and creepy and weird and weird. Did I say weird? But also like that extended into sexual things in this movie.
Yeah. But anyway.
But also Fester doesn't know what a virgin is.
No. I feel like they leaned too heavily on Fester being naive for this because that's too naive by 3 miles. But
I mean, don't get me wrong, if Fester was 16 years old and he was being controlled by such things, I would get it a little bit. I'd be like, hey man, been there, but you're an adult. Have some dignity.
Yes, yes, the two people say while they discuss their dignity on podcasts. So, anyway.
We're just putting it out there for the fans. We do it for the fans, really.
Yes. But the thing is that he's got Debbie, and Debbie's very interested in him. And unfortunately, they have exposition here in the form of a news bite where they mention that all these murders have happened and they're connected, and who is watching the TV but Debbie, and of course it is her that is the murderer. I would have much preferred if they had just not had that scene in the movie at all. Just keep going, it's unnecessary. We can figure out that she's an evil murderer. We'll put two and two together.
Well, it establishes that she showed up at the Adams house with the intent of marrying and killing Fester from the beginning. Not just that she showed up as the nanny and then happened to cross all of his stocks and bonds and decided then that it was a good idea to marry and kill him.
Right. Except that you could also have done that. Because she even has a slideshow about the people
the slide
that she's murdered.
So good. The slideshow is really good. Because all lunatics carry around a PowerPoint presentation about their lives. Like, that's absolutely perfectly on the nose for that character.
But this wasn't even a PowerPoint presentation. This is before PowerPoint presentations. Yeah. This is
she rolls old school with one of those the Polaroid the thingy-mabob slides.
She had a Don Draper honest to God Kodak carousel of murder stuff, incriminating murder stuff that she apparently drives around with in Debbie 2, her second car.
You know, I got one of those, not a Debbie 2 murder car, but a carousel guy.
Oh, okay.
It's behind me right now in this little footlocker over here.
Do you have any slides?
Probably somewhere. Hopefully they don't depict like murder or anything.
Yes. Well, that would be an important thing to rule out before you offer to show anyone anything on your slides.
I don't think I've been privy to any house fires that may have been caught on slides.
It's interesting the way that she managed to photograph some of these. Like,
where she's like 6 feet from running her husband into the garage door with the car, and she snapped a photo of it.
Yeah, or the one where she has the shadow of the axe blade that she's going to chop up that one husband with, but it's a camera that's taken from like 7 feet over and 35 to 40 degrees off axis of what that would be, but whatever.
I mean, you know, she's got her tricks or whatever where she puts her flashes and her strobes and things like that. So it's just, she's got an eye for photography is really what this comes down to.
Yeah. No, she's a very thoughtful person with a lot of inner life and good character traits. And photography is just one of her many facets. But she realizes that the children would pose a problem for her plans, so she would like to send them off to summer camp. And she not so cleverly or cunningly manipulates Morticia and Gomez into sending the children off to a summer camp. They're just idiots. And they take the kids over there, and the summer camp is full of hoity-toity, rich, awful, terrible people.
Normies.
Yeah. And this is basically the worst thing that you could do to Wednesday and Pugsley.
Well, I guess this is also the other thing about their family money, right? Like the reason people suffer them is because they are loaded. Because one of the other parents mumbles something about 20 grand for this summer camp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also full of the hoity-toity kids. So presumably it was 20 grand a pop for Wednesday and Pugsley to get there. And they're really just like the, it's like that scene in Blues Brothers where they go into the guy's fancy restaurant and just annoy everybody for fun until he agrees to come back in the band. Like that's the Addams family's entire existence. They're just there to stick it to the rich folk.
Yeah. And that is something that Wednesday and Pugsley go on to do. They are deposited with Peter McNichol and Christine Baranski as the counselors, the horrible grading counselors. And there is character actress lady as one of the parents. She makes a couple of appearances in the movie.
I thought one of them was other Cusack sister who's in some things, but I don't see her in the credits here.
No, this
you know
is
what I'm talking about. Who?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Who was in Gross Point Blank? I think, right?
Yeah,
yeah. But this is different. This is she was in Frasier. I can't remember the name that she played, but anyway, she's a character actress that had a lot of roles in the 90s. But she plays the mother of annoying blonde girl. They obviously don't get off to a great
start.
Oh, here
you go. This is Harriet Sansom Harris. Mm-hmm. Is her name.
Yes. Yeah. If you look at her IMDb, I'm sure it is full of credits for many, 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 many things.
Yeah. This. Okay. Yeah. So she's not credited as looking like that other Cusack. Is it? It's not a... God, isn't it another J Cusack? I can't remember.
Okay. You'll figure
Ann
it out.
Cusack. Ann Cusack okay. is who I'm thinking of. Not Ann Cusack. Oh, no.
Yeah, she's not in this. As you could tell by the fact that you couldn't find her in the credits.
Yeah, Harriet Harris is not Ann Cusack.
No. But they go off and do camp stuff. There's a nice scene where they're going to be rehearsing swimming and saving somebody who's drowning. And Peter McNichol says that the blonde girl is going to one of them has to be the victim and one of them has to be the one who rescues the person. And immediately the blonde girl volunteers that she's going to be the victim. And Wednesday says, for the rest of your life,
which pretty good line.
It's a pretty good line. Yeah. And so she jumps in and then Wednesday says she can't swim and isn't going to go after her. But obviously, you know, it's not actually peril. It just shows that they're not really like up for playing by the spirit of the camp rules and stuff.
Yeah, and I like the camp's immersion therapy where they like stick them in the little cabin full of like Happy Kitty posters and like Disney movies and crap to try and make them crack a smile and be happy like the rest of the kids.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to have a bad time at Camp Chippewa or whatever.
Yeah, and what's his face gets busted for reading, which is hilariously yes. against the rules. Peter McNichol even picks on him when he takes the book and says that he can't read four
He's
eyes.
Like, not on my time, nerd.
Yeah. And so that is what gets him introduced to Wednesday and Pugsley, and they start to ally themselves against the others in the camp. Curiously, at some point, Christine Baranski comes across the idea that Wednesday will be the perfect Pocahontas for their Thanksgiving thing, which is not how any of that should be working. But
Well, she calls her like our own dark haired outcast or whatever.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, that's.
Well,
that's a little much.
Yeah, she's written to be awful, and they're both written to be like awful and insensitive and not really get it. But at the same time, yes,
this is camp not woke.
Yes, yes. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Camp not woke. Yeah, that's awful. But anyway, they don't want to do it, and then eventually they're, you know, putting the immersion therapy thing again, and this time they pretend to crack, and Wednesday has a very famous little scene here where she tries to crack a smile and blonde girl's scared. They agree to go along with it. And of course, this results in a play that they sabotage by burning down all the huts and attacking everyone and tying them up while the parents kind of sit on the bleachers.
I like that they're roasting the camp counselors on a spit over a fire, and everyone's just like, what page is this on in the brochure here? I don't see that on the outline.
Mm, yeah. It's a little silly, because obviously that's not how that would function, but you know, there's a bit of catharsis there because they're just awful people, so you kind of just want them to you want to see them get their comeuppance, even though it's ridiculous. And you get a nice little moment between David Crumholtz and Wednesday when they're parting their ways at the fence, and she's like, I need to go, you know, protect my uncle. And David Crumholtz is like, I'm never going to forget you. And she's like, really? And he's like, yeah, you're too weird.
Yes. Yeah. That's a very David Crumholtz line there. That fits in perfectly.
Yeah. And, he gives her the gift of, what's her face as a retainer, which is a nice bonding moment.
Yeah. That girl didn't have braces. Why did she have headgear? I thought headgear was for braces.
I think you can sometimes wear that with retainers at night. Although I wouldn't put it past this movie to not have actually cared. But of course, meanwhile, when all that stuff was happening, Fester's being manipulated into marrying Debbie, and they go to Waikiki, and on their honeymoon he's sitting in a bathtub and she's talking about her cassette collection from Time Life,
and the bubble bath is up to his face so you can again make sure that he has no visible neck.
Mm-hmm. Very important characteristic. And mm-hmm. She throws the boombox into the water. There's sparks and a bunch of the vanity light bulbs break, but one somehow manages to land inside the water and go into Fester's mouth, and he does the...
It unscrews itself, yeah.
He does the characteristic Uncle Fester mouth on a light bulb thing, and this weirds Debbie out, and she gets very upset, and he apologizes, and he's trying to make nice, and she's just like, no, you don't get it. Like, you were supposed to die. She finally settles on her new plan that she's going to follow through with this, because he doesn't really know or understand anything. So she can take advantage of that to not have to be as intimate. And she can also exploit it to make sure that the family stays distant while she maneuvers things in such a way that she can become a widow through a more complicated plan. And this results in the weird upstate New York suburban mansion that they have with all the gaudy Baroque stuff that she bought in catalogs stuffed in there.
I mean, she's got the house and the furniture and the cars and stuff. Like, what's the big deal if Fester's still alive? Is it literally just the fact that he speaks to you a couple of times a day that you can't tolerate?
I mean, I wouldn't really want to spend a lot of time with him either.
Yeah, but just, you know. Make another one of your rules. Be like, I don't know. I mean, if we're going to be intimate, I really need to have 23 hours a day to myself where I don't see you. That way, when I do see you, I'm really into you or something. And he's dumb enough to fall for that kind of thing.
Yeah, except it seems that Deb is, how should I put this, unhinged and selfish.
Oh, yeah, well, you know, I guess one wrong Barbie and, you know, arson.
Yes. So her threshold for stuff is, you know, low. And
generally speaking, people have a slightly higher threshold for homicide.
Yeah, well, that's why we don't go around murdering each other, but if you're in this movie, you would probably want to have a lower threshold.
Well, you know, I mean, the Adams have a lot of money, so that, yeah, that changes the calculus for certain laws that you may or may not break.
Yeah, but there's a nice scene where the Adams is receive a postcard, and they're like, we want to see Fester. And she's all like, nope. Morticia has a nice thing about, like, oh, you got him under a sexual spell, and I could you know, you broke his spirit and da 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 da, and I could forgive all that, but pastels. And it just makes me chuckle.
That's good. It's a nice dig.
Yeah, and they get kicked out, but not before the curse, and she settles on her plan to celebrate their 3-week anniversary by blowing up the house with a bomb, which is full of cartoon dynamite and a literal ticking clock alarm clock. It's a very, very Wile E. Coyote what she's doing, but she puts it inside of a gift box that's one of those gift box where they have wrapped the box itself with a wrapped lid that is completely separate, and you drop it on top of it. So it's not even like sealed or anything in any way. But she casually leaves that on the dining room table, and Uncle Fester correctly predicts that it is a bomb. But he doesn't seem that put off or concerned by that. But Debbie freaks
out. He's an Adams. A bomb is a valuable gift to give to somebody. I mean, probably don't generally give it to people armed, but, you know, he would enjoy a nice Wile E. Coyote dynamite bomb.
Yeah. I mean, indeed, he does wind up enjoying that because he seems unfazed by it. But, she decides to go out for a little bit. She takes all of her luggage with her. She walks out the door, and she goes to some sort of Navy bar, where she meets Tony Shalhoub, and they're singing Macho Man by the Village People. She's talking about how that she's got to go back and see her husband for their anniversary, but she'll be right back. And
I like how the Macho Man sing along like accidentally turns into a conga line too when somebody walks past Tony Shalhoub.
I mean, what are you gonna do? It's Tony Shalhoub.
Everybody's a little drunk. You're having some fun. You're just dancing around and singing, and yeah, conga lines happen.
Yeah, especially when people are shouting, "Hey, hey, 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 hey!" You know, just bound to happen.
Keep going.
This, of course, is the climax. The house blows up. Fester's fine. He wanders out of there with the meatloaf. Deb is...
That's a very large meatloaf.
Yeah. Maybe they were going to save some for leftovers because it was such a good recipe. But Deb is a little concerned that her plan didn't go as planned. She's going to shoot him. But fortunately, Thing had been watching stuff. We saw him creeping around a window earlier, and he drives a car, which you might be thinking to yourself, how? And the answer is, you don't want to know, because it's too dumb, because he literally is jumping off of the wheel to go push the gas pedal or the brake, and then jumping back on to the steering wheel. But
see, the problem with that steering wheel thing is leverage, because if you can't, if your butt's not in a seat, you don't have a position of leverage to move the wheel left and right.
Right.
I don't think he's heavy enough to just like lean on the left side of the steering wheel and have it.
Yeah. I mean, if there's one thing this movie could really improve, it's the physics of severed hands. but that's you know, we'll just give them a C on that one. They could do better. They get out of there, and Debbie pursues them, and Debbie 2, the Mercedes, and runs over the meatloaf, which I like, because that lets you know that she's nearing the where they are at and following up on them and doesn't care about the meatloaf. He apologizes. Fester arrives at the Adams residence, apologizes.
I like that you just broke down the cinematic subtlety and meaning behind Debbie running over the meatloaf in the middle of the street.
I mean,
not just because they were like, it'd be funny if she ran over the meatloaf when she came around this car.
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't appreciate the artistry that Barry Sonnenfeld put into this. Like, there was a lot of thought. It was like,
there's a lot of subtext to the meatloaf, if we're honest about it.
I mean, is there a more practical meal than meatloaf? I would like to know.
And she's trampling over the practicality of Fester's love and or meatloaf.
Yes, she rejects something that is perfectly serviceable because she wants more. And
it's hearty. It would keep her fed and warm for days on end.
Yes.
And she doesn't want anything to do with it.
No, just like her relationship with Fester.
Exactly. It's really an indictment of marriage and love in the first place.
Yes. That is and exactly
the suburbs,
what it
and
is.
Just, you know, sort of the basic expectations of the home-cooked meal.
Yeah, and you really should not take for granted the meatloaf that you have.
Yeah, don't mm-hmm. look a gift meatloaf in the horse or whatever the hell that phrase is.
No, the IKEA got in trouble for that in Europe. But
oh boy, that was a rumor. That was a Snopes. I thought
that was actual news. But well, it doesn't really matter. But anyway, Fester apologizes to Gomez, and Gomez calls him Mr. Debbie or Mr. Deb. Which is pretty nice the way Raul Julia delivers that again with that Shakespearean gravitas and intonation for something that is absolutely absurd. But Fester says he's an Adams and apologizes to everybody, including the kids. And just in time for Debbie to show up with her shotgun. And somehow they cut from that to them all being shackled in electrical chairs to get zapped. Somehow one Deb with a shotgun was enough to convince all of them to do that, I guess. It seems like they should maybe have, I don't know, outmaneuvered her in some way, considering there were so many of them and they all seem to like eat danger for breakfast and, you know, like enjoy knife throwing competitions and stuff. But, maybe they knew how things would all work out. So they went along with it. They seemed to like the slideshow.
It was a good slideshow.
Yeah. And grandma really understood, you know, what about your needs? She really got where Deb was coming from with all of her very valid and relevant concerns that were grounded in reality. Meanwhile, the baby who had turned into a blonde toddler who was possessed by the, I don't know, disunion in the family, whatever, there's a belch of fire and then the room decor has changed back and the baby is on its way downstairs and there is a bowling ball and crawling toddler puppet tree shenanigans and stuff, and then the bowling ball hits a plank and then he's launched through a skylight and then
a human Rube Goldberg device surrounded by a baby that ultimately ends up thwarting Deb's plan to electrocute the family.
Yes, but we get a nice little callback to the camp because we have the parents and the blonde kid on the aircraft when the baby goes up to the window.
And then oh, back sure, that's nice. And then I appreciated the look where they all just sort of like look at each other and then she slowly closes the thing there on the airplane.
Yeah. And then,
by the way, I got a lot of good airplane content after this last thing here.
you got a good chunk of material to take on the road with you.
I could do a 30, 40 minute Seinfeld set on airplanes just off this one Florida trip.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, let's finish this movie because it's almost done. So after the slideshow and the baby falling from the sky, the baby lands by the electrical wiring that it needs to and is able to see the blue optically composited electricity going through the cable and switch the cable.
Mm-hmm.
And then Debbie is electrocuted and turns to dust. Visa Gold and American Express gold cards clank to the ground in her dusty remains.
You know, I just got an email today from American Express for a limited time. If you sign up for an American Express gold card by I think the end of November, you can get it in rose gold.
Oh, I bet Debbie wish she had it.
They're going to suck in so many suckers just because they're going to be like, oh, God, limited edition rose gold American Express. Sign me up.
Yeah. Nothing says limited edition like your credit score. But they have a sometime later a little recap here, epilogue, where they deal with what has transpired. And it is apparently a year later since the birth of the baby. We know that because there's a birthday for the baby being 1 year old. And in that intervening time, David Krumholtz has come over to cosplay as Wednesday's father, and they are getting along so well. But they go over to Debbie's grave, and David Krumholtz is like, "Oh, you know, I pity her. She was sick, and blah 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 blah." And Wednesday's like, "No, she was sloppy." and I would never have been as sloppy. I would have really, you know, just scared him to death. And then he leans over the grave, and then a hand comes up, and then you get the TV show theme. And then, unfortunately, we launch into the 1993 hit, Whoop, There
Don't
It
you
Is.
Don't dare sing it, because it was stuck in my head all day today. I was so mad that, oh, God, like, once it's in there, it's going to stay in there. It's already seeping its way back into my brain right now, because some of the words...
It's such a complicated set of lyrics. I'm surprised you remember it.
Oh, just the chorus. The chorus is so bad.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to call it a chorus.
You see, the one-hit wonders behind Whoop, There It Is were commissioned to make a remix of Whoop, There It Is that just has words Adam's Family thrown in it. So they do that, and that's in the end credits. And similarly, I mentioned to you last night, which you do had forgotten, is MC Hammer has a horrible, horrible Adam's Family rap that he has for the credits of the first film, and there's a music video and everything.
Kill It With Fire is all I can say. It's one of the worst songs in the history of songs.
Barry Sonnenfeld somehow had a knack for finding someone whose career had peaked and was on its way down and commissioning them to do the end credit titles.
Like Will
for
Smith
these...
with all of his Men in Black songs.
Well, no, his career was going up, but his music career was going down, actually.
I know. Yeah. And it should have stayed there.
But, you know, what if Will Smith had done this? Instead of Whoop, There It Is, we could have got, you know, Wiki Wednesday Adams.
Oh, God.
But instead, you got Whoop, There It Is. Over and over and over and over again. One thing I forgot is how much I like the film score by Mark Scheiman. He did the first one and this one, and it's got, like, you know, it's a harpsichord and your weird European romance gothic stuff in here.
Sure.
It's a lot of fun. Nothing.
You don't
nothing
often get something that that campy and gothic-y.
No, because I feel like this is the sort of situation that nowadays you'd be like, hire Danny Elfman. But this was before Barry Sonnenfeld started working with Danny Elfman. So it predated that. But I think Mark did a good job. And you might not recognize his name, but he did another movie that I know that you like, which is South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
You know that title's a pun?
Mm-hmm.
It took me a couple of times before somebody explained that to me.
But when they explained it to you, it was just like, whoop, there it is, and you got it. Just...
Not so much the whoop, but,
it
you know,
whoop?
Just like, and it, well...
It wasn't even, you know, just... no whooping?
Whoop is a sound that would generally come along with a certain level of exposure that I would prefer not to be involved in.
Oh, yes. You don't want to expose your Bigger, Longer, and Uncut to whooping.
No, this is an instance where you definitely want to tell and not show.
No. Anyway, it's. I mean, you know, as sequels go, could be worse. It could be better.
When compared to the first one, and when evaluating this movie against its goals and what it was trying to do and its audience, you know, could have been a lot worse. It was successful within a narrow window of criteria for what success looks like.
Yes, high praise. I believe Ebert had given the first movie a thumbs down and this one a thumbs up. Siskel still gave both of them thumbs down, so you know, there's a little room in there, a little gray area between the thumbs up and the thumbs down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is another movie file away in the category of remember when they used to make movies like that, because this is not a thing that would ever happen again.
This is a very peculiar monstrosity. But I mean, I have fun watching it. It was an interesting walk down memory lane since I haven't seen this in eons. And I also, enjoy all the thing stuff, the pointless hand stunts that are going on in this film.
He does like a disco roller derby on that thing?
Yeah, like at the beginning of the movie, all of a sudden he's just like jumping around on a roller skate for literally no reason, but he's having fun. And there's a montage of it because I guess kids loved seeing Thing from the first film. And there are some of these shots of Thing that are digitally composited.
Those are the ones that look extra bad?
No, the ones that look extra bad are the optical composites where it's like crunchy. You have the black shadows of the hand are like really harsh and cut out looking. Mm. But there are some really good ones, I thought. Anyway, not everything, but it's impressive when you consider it's 1993. I certainly would not want to use 1993 tools to try to make a severed hand walk around a set.
There are in fact a handful of pretty good shots in this movie.
A handful. That was good, Dan.
Thank you. I tried my best. I was waiting for an opportunity to throw that in there.
Yeah. And for people who at home who might be like, oh, how'd they do it where you get the cross section of the wrist? Well, that's easy. It's a prosthetic wrist where they actually have that cross section, and it's mounted above the actual wrist, which they don't include.
Oh, see? You learn something new every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Movie magic. And then they have the guy who is actually a magician, FYI, a sleight of hand artist. His hand runs around on the set. He does that stuff in these two movies. Same guy.
Did they put him in like some blue screen, or was he in black to try and like hide himself?
I can't remember. I could have sworn I read a Cinefix about it a long time ago, and I think they actually used different stuff depending on the kind of shot setup that they had. And there's some of these where there's just a prosthetic hand. Like there's a shot where the car is first sneakily driving up on Deb, and the hand is on the top of the steering wheel, slowly turning back and forth. That's you just had a prosthetic sculpted hand just wrapped around the steering wheel, and then you have somebody underneath moving the wheel. that's also much less expensive movie magic. I feel like nowadays somebody would have been, that wouldn't have even occurred to somebody. They would have been like, no, here's a person wearing seven different colors of blue and they're sitting in the driver's seat. Please clean plate all of this out and put the hand back in. I feel like that would be the modern approach. But you could tell that they at least, you know, like storyboarded and thought about like how they would do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the miniature of Deb's house that they blew up was like 28 feet big, long-ish thing. It was
a huge explosion. Yeah. When it blew up, I was looking. I'm like, this doesn't look like a blue screen to me.
Well, the one where she's sitting in the car and it explodes behind her is a blue screen. You can tell the sheer fabric in her morning shawl thing.
Oh,
that
in
she's
the collar
got
area? Yeah.
Yeah. If you look, there's actually like noise in there that's fluctuating. As the explosion goes on, the explosion itself is nice because I was like, I like miniature explosions. You know, you get your Independence Day where you blow up your tiny little Capitol buildings and your tiny little White Houses and stuff. It's always fun.
Every now and again, you kind of want to blow up a full size one.
Shh, Dan.
Maybe film, maybe not.
Dan. You know, we don't want to get this. We don't want to get ourselves into any trouble.
That's fine. Nobody listens to this. Yeah.
It was a nice little slander from Grandma, too, when she's talking about all the horrible things. The baby could be a lawyer, an orthodontist, president.
Although, you know, they're saying, oh, no, he could be this straight-laced person, and that would be horrible. But if the president's a monster, that's kind of Adam's Family-esque.
Yeah. Well, now I think we have just enough time for some airplane material. Do you want to try it out before you take it on the road, or is this the kind of thing where people should turn off the recording devices so that the material seems fresh every night that you test it out?
Yeah, please put your cell phones down put them in a Ziploc bag at the front door because, you know, I'm workshopping these jokes for my special that's going to be on HBO in 2 years.
Oh, no, Dan, Netflix special. Come on.
Oh, Netflix. Sorry. Netflix or Prime. Yeah, I'm gonna sit on a stage in a chair and talk to Barack Obama for an hour. No, I don't. I don't have any material. It was the same things I was angrily tooting about on Mastodon. Just like,
oh, you were angry about something?
two separate 4-hour flights from Phoenix to Charlotte. I ended up sitting next to the guy who likes to sleep sideways in his chair and take up all of the room available to him and partially me, and take his shoes off at the same time. Oh my God, these people! Like, also, I appreciate that neither of them wanted to irritate myself or my wife by getting up and going to the bathroom repeatedly, which, you know, on a 4-hour flight is a very reasonable thing. I feel like there should be some sort of, like, I don't know, you need like a note from your doctor in order to get a window seat to just to confirm that you have the bladder strength to not be a pain in the ass for everybody. But they were good in that respect. But airplanes, it's the worst. It smells, the food. Hey, Amanda ordered like one of those like little $9 like hummus cups or whatever that you scoop out with like a like two pretzels and then it's empty.
Because
there's no food anymore. So we basically didn't eat anything for 10 hours with all of the different travel. You got to sprint from one side to the other. We had a 3-hour layover on our way back between at Charlotte, between Daytona and Charlotte, and then come back to Phoenix. And apparently 3 hours isn't long enough for the people in Charlotte to move bags from one airplane to the other. It took them 2 more hours to put our bags on a different flight that just showed up 2.5 hours later, which was super duper helpful. I appreciated that. Oh God, I hate travel so much.
Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, that was real funny, wasn't it? Don't worry, it'll be funny by the time it gets to Netflix. I'll work it out. I'll throw some characters in there. I'll throw some banter back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to do voices for the people that you talk to for the baggage claim.
Sir, yeah. We'll send our bags to you as soon as possible. We'll find them and we'll have them brought to you. Oh, it was so great. They're like, it'll be that plane lands at like 9:40. We'll try to get it out to you tonight, but it'll probably be our first delivery tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. And what that means is they call you at 8 a.m. and then they say, remember those bags that you already told us you wanted us to deliver? We're just confirming that you want those delivered, and then we'll be there sometime before 2 p.m. It's like, great. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. You had places to go. People to see.
I got stuff in there. I got some expensive shoes and some things.
Was all
the
your
toothbrush
stuff okay?
Was in there. We had to go buy another toothbrush.
Oh.
It's not helpful.
Well, that's not helpful. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do normal people roll backup toothbrush at home just in case that the airline loses their stuff?
Well, I have an electric toothbrush, so I don't take that traveling with me. I have a travel toothbrush that I take with me. One of those little foldy guys. Because I also
you're a foldy guy.
Yeah, because I don't
you ever,
like
flick it out like it's a switchblade.
You don't really want to do that because it might fly out of your hand, and then you have a hotel floor toothbrush. So don't do that. Be very careful with your toothbrush. I prefer having a travel toothbrush for that distinct function because it's much better at being put away inside of the toiletry bag and stuff without getting like if you take like one of the regular size toothbrush, it doesn't fit inside the snack bag, you know, horizontally. You got to like put it in there like diagonally, and then it's like,
well, you got to get one of those toothbrush holders. You don't have a toothbrush holder, the little plastic guy that goes in half.
Those get so gross. Like, I don't want to do like a UV light swab on that thing.
Wash it out or throw it away. It costs like $2.
Yeah, well, or just use the baggies.
You get the ones, I think my dentist gives them to me, the one that just, it's like a little rectangle of plastic that closes just around the end tip of the toothbrush.
I don't trust that.
I don't trust those at all, because they come open in like 5 seconds. I think you used one time, and it's like, oh, this didn't work.
Also, it's full of like little drainage holes and stuff. So
what's that protecting anything from?
Yeah, nothing. It's protecting it from physically touching the brush, but other than that, it's just, might as well just have an open door, just let all the germs in.
Exactly. This is my toothbrush. It's supposed to brush my teeth, not supposed to brush the inside of this little piece of plastic here, full of germs.
Yeah, yeah. And that case thing, you know, it's just a breeding ground for microorganisms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Frankly, it's amazing that this trip went off as well as it did, because I guess it was just like, it was one of those things that I kept putting off, like, oh yeah, it's out there in the future, whatever. I don't really worry about it. Luckily, I booked the flights and that was fine. But I just TLDR'd the rest of the plans. I was just like, we don't need a car. We'll just take an Uber to the Airbnb because we're staying. My cousin was booking the Airbnb, and we're just going to like Venmo them some cash or whatever, and we'll stay with them. So they got all that squared away. So we'll just take an Uber there. And I was like, well, wait a minute. We're going to be here for a couple of days. We should still probably rent a car. So we just went to, have you been to the Daytona Beach Airport?
No.
It is incredibly small. It's probably smaller than whatever grocery store you go to. It's weird. Luckily, the gal was still there at the front desk, and they had a car there. The way they're, you know how rental cars at airports usually work out that, you know, you go to the desk, and then you got to go out there to the little parking deck, and you got to find your number, and then you got to go through the security thing that's got the big metal door that they don't lower until they verify your ID and your stuff and all that, and then they let you out, and you can't come back in because there's the spike strips and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This was just a girl at a desk, and she ran my credit card, handed me the keys, and she's like, parking lot's out there. It's the car in 11. And there's no guard. There's no nothing. You just get in the car, and you drive away. And then when you come back, you just drive into the parking lot, and you park in one of the spots, and you just walk in and hand them the keys. And I was like, I feel like I'm doing something wrong here, but the airport is legitimately so small that you're basically in 1960, where nobody cares. Like, you could just walk in and, like, you know, steal one of the cars if you wanted to. Like, there's not even one of those like fake little pole that comes down to like try and pretend to block you in. It's just a parking lot next to the door.
Yeah, the Long Beach airport is like that. Mm. Maybe Burbank too. Although I've never actually gone through the car rental process at Burbank. It just seems like it's very tiny. But one time we had to adjust who the drivers were on a rental car that my brother-in-law got, and we were going to add Jason to it, and we had to stop at a location, a rental car location. We just figured it would be easier to stop at the Long Beach one on our route to San Diego than it would be to stop at the Los Angeles International Airport one. Sure enough, that was exactly the case, because you drive into a lot, and there was like a school trailer like thing with an air conditioner on the side in the middle of the lot, and that was the office for the rental car.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and so they did that, and then we just got back in the car and we left, and I was just like, is there a certain way we need to drive in, you know, just like you. I was worried, like, we're not gonna like blow out these tires by like reversing out of here somewhere weird.
Right.
Yeah,
but when you notice when they have like six parking spots per rental agency, and they're all kind of in the same parking lot, you're like, oh, they don't really take things too seriously over here.
No.
Like, you drive in, and nobody's doing a walk around inspection of the car. Nobody's got that little, like, you know, wireless receipt printer on the side of their hip where they got the little gun that scans the VIN number off the car. Like, there's none of that going on at this type of place.
Must be refreshing.
Yeah, and then the other thing was, you know, it was the Airbnb, and then I looked back in my conversation, and she's like, oh, we'll be there from Thursday night to Sunday, we're heading back, and I'm like, okay, cool, we'll come in Friday, and we'll leave Monday or whatever for work stuff, and that was really the extent of the conversation, which you know, clearly there was a little bit of a disconnect there, because we didn't have anywhere to stay Sunday night, so, like, it was, like, the night of the wedding, and we're all, like, half lit at the wedding, and somebody's like, oh yeah, they're leaving tomorrow, where are you guys staying? I'm like, what do you mean? We're staying at the place with them. She's like, oh, I thought they were leaving. So I'm like, yeah, well, let's go find out. She's like, yeah, the house is gone tomorrow. I'm like, oh, cool. So the day after the wedding, when we're all gonna be super hungover, we got to be out of this Airbnb at 10 a.m. That's super smart planning. Thank you. Appreciate that. Shouldn't have done this at all. But as luck would have it, their parents were staying at somebody's beachfront condo, ways up the road.
So that explains the migration that you had to watching football and having beer and koozies over at a second location.
Yeah, well, it's like, are we going to be hungover enough that I'm going to roll over in bed and open my Airbnb app and then just book this same house for one night by myself and pay three times the rate because it's just me? Or are we going to try and find a hotel nearby or whatever? And they're like, oh, just come stay. And it's like, it's always the worst possible thing when somebody says, like, oh, we got room at our place, come stay. Because they say it to, like, everybody. Like, if you need a place to stay, come crash. And, you know, some other guy was going to crash too, but he was going to be there on a couch. But he had a hotel that he insisted on staying at or something. So it turned out that we had the guest room. It was great. But, yeah, you're in a 50-year-old condo building. That it has, humorously, it has a love seat and three recliners pointed at a big screen TV. And they got a little kitchen. It's got a little guest room with two of the smallest, like, I Love Lucy beds separate. You know, I think no less than a half dozen jokes were made about pushing the two little beds together. wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's like, it's fine. We're exhausted and hungover. Like, we can just go to sleep for a couple hours and then get up and go to our plane in the morning. It's not that big a deal. But, yeah, you got the giant sliding glass door. You go out there and you got your high top chairs made out of PVC pipe that you sit in and look at the ocean. And how come you didn't warn me that in Florida people drive on the beach? Their cars are allowed on the beach. It's a thing.
That's just a Daytona thing.
That's just a Daytona. Okay, because I was like, you know, and the condos are all kind of elevated, but the water comes up probably 30 yards from the condo at high tide. And these cars are taking a good 15 of those yards to drive. So, like, there's a good chance that people get hit by cars on the beach in this area. Kind of freaked me out a little bit.
I would say that it probably happens a bit, but I don't have
the
figures.
And they say daily
figures.
Cars get stuck in the sand because why not?
Yeah, well, also people drive onto the sand with vehicles that are not appropriate for such activities.
I saw a Toyota Camry down there. Like, yeah. you got somebody with a RAV4 and a Toyota. Like, just people should not be driving down there, but they're just like, hey, look at me, look what I can do. And it's like, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah, no.
So the beach entrances and exits are like once every like half mile. So if you get stuck halfway down, like, what are you going to do?
Call for help. Something tells me that's the majority of the complaining is my car got stuck. But it's something they're known for, I guess. But that's neither here nor there, because it's not Waikiki, and it's not the Addams Family Values movie, and it's not the wonderful discussion that we had, which we should close out.
I feel bad now. I hope this was all like post show. We probably didn't end the other show, did we?
No, because you were going into your airplane material.
I got airplane material. I got all kinds of material.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about the airplane material later then, Dan. And definitely not right now. So, goodbye. And whoomp. There it is.
No, put it back away.
Makes three. Wednesday Pugsley alert you ring. Fest up grandmama and thing. Wait, can't forget cousin it. Tag team reps another party hit. Come it's on. The Addams Family movie theme. Gomez Morticia. Come on, sing.